Meanwhile, I would like to introduce our next presenter. Michael Heller is a doctoral candidate in ethnomusicology at Harvard University with specializing in jazz and especially musician-run organizations during the avant-garde era of jazz. He's been the recipient of several awards, including Harvard's Oscar Schaefer Prize and the Kate Neal Kinley Fellowship from my alma mater, the University of Illinois. He's also the director of Harvard's Dudley House Jazz Band, a graduate student ensemble that recently premiered a new arrangement of Mary Lou Williams' landmark Zodiac Suite. His current research deals with the New York loft scene in the 1970s, and today he's going to talk about the Juma Sultan Archive.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back here, and it's an honor to be on a panel with Doug and Susan here. I also want to thank ARS, too. I came to my first ARS conference last year as the recipient of a travel grant and loved it so much that I'm back again. And it's a pleasure to be presenting some of my work for so many esteemed archivists and engineers. My own background is in history and ethnomusicology, as Roberta mentioned. So one thing I sort of, and I'll get into it a little bit and happy to talk about it more, this archival project is something I was thrown into that I didn't completely expect. And one of the reasons I wanted to start coming to ARS conference was to learn about the process and the industry. So if anyone here hears things during the course of the presentation where you're saying, now why did he do that? Or, that's idiotic, he should have done it this other way. Please tell me, I welcome constructive criticism of all kinds. So let's dive in. In recent years, there's been a burst of scholarship that surrounds musician-run jazz organizations of the 1960s and 1970s. Throughout this period, a range of aesthetic, economic, and political motives spurred musicians to form collective organizations to promote and present their music. The best known of these groups, of course, is the AACM in Chicago, founded in 1965. But by the early 1970s, there were similar initiatives in St. Louis, Detroit, New Haven, Connecticut, Jackson, Mississippi, and even right here in Los Angeles. Now, as scholars have noted, these activities not only had musical significance, but they often emphasized political themes and social themes, including self-empowerment, economic independence, and African-American creative agency. And historian Eric Porter even talks to these as being connected to a larger black arts imperative, which he also connects with dance and visual arts and the civil rights movement and so on. Around the same time, a similar set of activities was emerging in New York, but with a slightly different structure. Whereas musician-run activities in other parts of the country were usually based around these large citywide collectives, in New York, there was a more diverse set of activities that started springing up in former manufacturing lofts in Lower Manhattan. At the time, there was a series of real estate shifts that made these lofts available at remarkably low prices, and their high ceilings and open floor plans made them well-suited to serve as not only residences, and a lot of artists lived there, but art galleries, performance spaces, workshops, meeting spaces, and so on. Where visual artists set up mostly in Soho and really started the Soho art scene, musicians set up lofts in the surrounding neighborhoods as well, including NoHo, the East Village, and the Lower East Side. While these organizers often shared the goals and the ideals of these Midwestern collectives, and especially musician ownership and a tendency toward the avant-garde, the comparative ease in New York of obtaining space made forming a centralized organization less essential. And as a result, the city developed a much different and more dispersed landscape for these musician-run events. Now, these varied activities were, and often they still are, referred to as the cohesive loft movement, or the loft era, or the loft scene. These are terms that you hear for it. But their disjointed nature presents special challenges for scholars. And on top of this, a downturn in the jazz recording industry meant that musicians in the loft didn't tend to make a lot of commercial records. But what is missing from the commercial sphere is adequately compensated by substantial collections of private recordings that musicians would make themselves. The growing affordability of amateur recording equipment at the time allowed artists to document their own works, although often these collections vary in both scope and audio fidelity. Unlike commercial records, these collections aren't easy to find in stores or libraries, or you can't download them online, and instead, a new engagement with private archives is necessary to probe this period. So this presentation is going to introduce one such archive, and it was compiled and kept by bassist and percussionist Juma Sultan. Now, Sultan's biggest claim to fame is he was one of the two percussionists in Jimi Hendrix's performance on Woodstock. That's what you're seeing on the right side there. Juma's in the background in the purple pants. But just after that, he moved to New York and began organizing events at one of the early loft spaces called Studio We, and that's zooming in on that particular. That's a photo that's pasted onto a wooden backing material that he has in his collection. During his time at Studio We, Sultan recorded hundreds of performances and rehearsals, not just there, but throughout the city, compiling one of the most extensive collections of loft materials. And these are some photos from inside Studio We, different parts of the studio. Now, by considering the Sultan Archive today, I hope to raise questions talking about what an engagement with private archives can offer jazz historiography, a field which has, for better and worse, often focused primarily on commercial recordings as the launching point for scholarship. I want to consider how one might use such an archive, though it's highly personal, incomplete, and decentralized, as an inroads into this period in jazz, also highly decentralized and fragmented. So to begin, I want to go through a brief overview of the Sultan collection. The Juma Sultan Archive currently contains 433 reels of audio, 159 photo prints, 34 contact sheets with additional photos, 26 reels of film, and over 10,000 pages of documents. The materials were collected during a period spanning roughly between 1968 and 1978, and relate mostly to musical events in the city, although some also chronicle Sultan's earlier work in the Woodstock area. The collection includes many luminaries of the jazz avant-garde, including Pharoah Sanders, Archie Shepp, Sam Rivers, Sun Ra, Calla Purusha, Maurice McIntyre, and I listed some others there at the bottom. But it also contains dozens of lesser-known musicians who left little to no footprint on commercial records. When Sultan left New York during the 1980s, the bulk of these materials were transported to his current home in Kerhonkson, New York, which is just outside of Woodstock as well. And they remained there largely untouched for nearly 25 years. He began the process of organizing and cataloging the materials in 2004, gaining a small amount of support from the National Endowment for the Arts and from Clarkson University. And most of those funds led to the setup of Juma's website, which has clips from the collection, jumasarchive.org, which I encourage everyone to look out. Very cool stuff on there. In the fall of 2009, I traveled to Kerhonkson for 5 months to study the collection and to assist in the cataloging and preservation initiative. Though we had minimal, really had no funding for equipment of any kind in this, we worked to achieve four goals. First, we transferred all the materials to acid-free archival boxes, which had been obtained in 2004 as part of the Clarkson Initiative. Second, working with Sultan, I created a catalog of the archive's holdings, recording all relevant metadata from the tape boxes and notes, and actually, like the Savory collection and Lauren's work on it, I did this through a large, unwieldy Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, which I can show to anyone later on, too. Third, we assessed the physical condition of the tapes, and then using a motley assortment of any equipment that we could beg, borrow, and steal from any source, we started creating low-quality digital transfers of the recordings that were in stable condition. We didn't do this because we wanted to do them in low quality. We did this because we wanted to create some backup copies, and it was the only option we had available. To date, we've transferred 148 of the 433 tapes in this way. And fourth, after creating an inventory, we made digital scans of the documents in the collection, all 10,000 plus pages, and again, did this using less than archival standards, but at least wanted to create safety copies in case anything happened to the originals, and I'll talk about how the originals are stored later on. While pursuing this work, I simultaneously took notes on the materials and conducted several interviews with Sultan, which is all part of my ongoing dissertation work on the period. Now, as the lofts were designed as mixed-use spaces, so the materials in the Sultan collection vary widely in both intent and content. And this becomes clear when considering the audio recordings, which were created for a variety of reasons. In our discussions, Sultan identified at least four overlapping motivations for recording his work, and they are pedagogy, commercial reasons, historical documentation, and then experimentation. So I'll use these as sort of a roadmap to play some examples from the collection. So the pedagogical use of tapes relates to musicians' attempts to improve their musical skills through self-assessment. And Sultan cited this as his initial inspiration for buying a tape machine and starting to record himself in the 1960s. He wanted to hear himself, what he sounded like, and how to improve. the same way many musicians have done and still do. The approach was used in group rehearsals as well, which would be recorded and played back to promote discussion and development in ensembles, which is especially important when you're dealing with music that's almost entirely freeform and improvised. A large percentage of the tapes are rehearsals that were taped for this reason. So as the first example, I'm going to play an excerpt from a rehearsal by Sonny Simmons. More volume on it too. I hear someone say it's too loud. It's tough for me to hear back here, but okay. And is there sound coming from that speaker? Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Cool. The second motivation was commercial reasons, which is not only to release commercially, but also for things like demo tapes to send to producers and so forth. For several years, Sultan actually ran a sort of semi-professional recording studio out of Studio Wee, where musicians could rent time to record albums or demos. Only a few records were ever released from this, but a lot of these tapes ended up in Sultan's collection, and they show attempts at a more professional type of approach with discrete takes and so forth, whereas the rehearsal tapes often go straight through, you hear musicians talking in between and so forth. So I have two examples from this. First, a recording by percussionist Danielle Benzebulon playing a piece called Darn My Socks.
Hey man, but darn my socks, there goes a fox. Which way did she go, John? Which way did fox is a woman who is so sly. She shakes up men when she walks by. She's got a smile.
And then a second example of this, I have a band called the Juice Quartet, led by Alan Juice Glover, and they did many takes of their rendition of Maurice Ravel's Bolero. So here's one of the takes, portion of it. The third motivation was historical documentation, especially of live performances. These materials were things that were kept because musicians believed that certain events had historical importance and deserved to be documented. And a prime example of this was the 1972 New York Musicians Festival, which was a massive event that included over 500 musicians and arose that year in opposition to George Wein's Newport in New York Festival. That was the first year Wein had come to New York. The event attracted large crowds. It got a whole lot of press coverage, both domestic and international. But it's scarcely mentioned in jazz history texts, and Juma hopes that he can begin to address that through the presence of recordings, because they recorded a great deal of the activities that happened. Here's a performance from the festival by Pharoah Sanders. Oh. playing. I'll leave it to the imagination how they got from that Latin groove into the free jazz jam session, but it was seamless. lastly, are what I refer to as experimental tapes. And this category overlaps with their pedagogical use, but I draw a distinction in the role that the recording plays in the process. Namely, I refer to things as pedagogical when they're intended to act as passive inscriptions of a planned musical event. I wrote this piece, what will this sound like? As opposed to experimentalist approaches where they were using experimentalist processes, combining sounds and seeing what ended up happening on the tape. So one example that I have is the infamous tape T0163, recorded in Woodstock in the late 1960s, and it consists entirely of Sultan and one or two other musicians playing sparse improvisations next to a lake that was filled with croaking frogs. It goes on for about an hour and a half like this. Now, spillage between these four categories remains frequent, or was and remains frequent. And a prime example of such slippage can be several tapes in the collection identified as samplers of Juma's band, the Aboriginal Music Society. They would take some of their rehearsal tapes and they would splice out excerpts of them and repackage them to be sent to record companies or concert producers to promote themselves. So that's an instance of something originally done for pedagogical purposes being repackaged into a commercial use. And similarly, sometimes live performances were sort of spliced together into audio pastiches. And of course, nearly anything in the collection can be used now in the efforts of historical documentation. In such examples, though, it becomes clear how the deployment of these archival materials becomes as crucial as the point of inscription in establishing the living significance of an item or of a collection. I think I'm going to skip over. I had a few words about the documents in the collection, but I'm running short on time, so I'll flip by these. That, by the way, is a performance contract signed by Archie Shepp, but not until there were considerable revisions made, as you can see. And I could talk about that more to anyone afterwards who's interested. But I do want to talk a bit about the implications of a collection like this for historiography and archival practice. Now, in launching his archive project in 2004, Sultan has explicitly attempted to use the force of his materials to alter conceptions about jazz in the 1970s, foregrounding the Lofts as an important and largely unacknowledged site for musical development. In doing so, his actions implicitly acknowledge the role that archivists can play in shaping historical practice, a point which has also been made in several instances by critical theorists, critical historians, and archival theorists. In his 1969 text, The Archaeology of Knowledge, for example, Michel Foucault brought attention to the archive's generative power on the construction of discourses. For Foucault, the archive represented not just a passive collection of stagnant objects, but was the most basic groundwork from which statements can be constructed. And as such, the archive becomes for him a key metaphor for knowledge itself. More recently, archival theorists like Joan M. Schwartz and Terry Cook have advocated that archivists become more aware of the significance of their own actions. Following Foucault, they point out that the archivist's decisions constitute the first step in forming connections that may dictate how, when, and where history is written. And to quote them, "Archives, as records, wield power over the shape and direction of historical scholarship, collective memory, and national identity, over how we know ourselves as individuals, groups, and societies. And ultimately, in the pursuit of their professional responsibilities, archivists, as keepers of archives, wield power over those very records before they come to archives, their appraisal and selection as archives, and afterwards, their constantly evolving description, preservation, and use." For the archivist, then, ongoing efforts must be made to question the assumptions that underlie their organizational systems. to allow historians to excavate hidden stories and meanings that might otherwise be lost. Now, the goals of an archivist like Sultan are somewhat different, although they too acknowledge the archive's power over historical discourse. In framing his collection as emblematic of a lost history, Sultan positions it as a corrective to jazz narratives that omit lost activities. And in this respect, the work less resembles the large state and institutional archives that are talked about by people like Foucault and Schwartz and Cook, but rather resemble a subaltern archive constructed in opposition to dominant narratives. Other theorists have described similar subaltern collections, including David Scott's discussion of the Marcus Garvey collection at UCLA. I gradually came to realize that embedded in the seemingly quotidian construction of this archive, there was an activity of thinking and imagination that opened out vast possibilities, not just of memory, but of counter-memory, the moral idiom and semiotic registers of remembering against the grain of history of New World Black deracination, subjection, and exclusion. Scott's formulation here in terms of counter-memory rather than counter-history is key to the argument. Although memories are fallible and they're subject to interpretation, they're remarkably resilient and often constitute the basis for broader notions of tradition and community. In this sense, memories act with considerable force on the individuals who build them, acting against attempts at historical erasure. The potential success of Sultan's project rests in its goal to restructure collective memory by opening new avenues for discourse, avenues that were impossible to formulate using prior materials and approaches. Now, like many personal archives, his work makes no claims to objectivity, but instead it attempts to take an active role in the portrayal and promotion of himself and his musical compatriots from the Loft era. This again reinforces the ethics of ownership that underlies so many aspects of the Loft movement. And so to conclude, I want to talk about the current state and future prospects of the collection. Despite recent progress, the Sultan Archives remain stored in less than ideal conditions. The materials remain at Sultan's home in Kerhonkson, where they're stored in an unfinished barn, offering minimal protection from the elements. That's a picture of the barn on the upper left-hand corner. Sultan himself remains undecided as to the collection's fate. While he sometimes considers donating the materials to a university or library to allow for better storage and cataloging, at other times he leans towards self-releasing select tapes as commercial records and wants to work with surviving musicians to get some form of remuneration for their work. Part of his indecisiveness in this stems from the original intent of the materials and the lofts in general. Since the period emphasized reclaiming creative and economic control over their musical output, the thought of giving away the collection for free often seems like a poor prospect. A third option has been to seek additional outside support to fund Sultan's own continued work on the collection, as he got in 2004 from the NEA. But here, the project has met with little support in the current economic climate. The search for solutions to such challenges was a major motivation for me to attend the ARS conference both last year and this year, and I welcome thoughts or suggestions by those in the audience who have encountered similar challenges. But despite these obstacles, the collection has begun to attract increasing attention from several sources. In addition to my own research, a book about the archive written by Clarkson's Stephen Farina is forthcoming from Wesleyan University Press. And on the sonic front, a 3-disc box set of music from the collection is currently under production by Aramite Records, featuring recordings made by Sultan's band, the Aboriginal Music Society. And these are early mock-ups of both, but the album is scheduled to be out this fall. The book project is sort of in the glacial world of the publishing industry, but it has been accepted for publication. Perhaps most significantly, the Archives Preservation Initiative has recently received a pledge of support by engineer Warren Russell Smith, a multiple Grammy-winning restoration specialist who has pledged to assist in creating archive-quality transfers of the materials from the collection. Very happy to have that, which will be a big step up from the types of transfers we were doing. As I mentioned at the outset, the Sultan Collection represents just one of many private collections that document New York loft activities. While its preservation doesn't guarantee a complete historical snapshot of the period, such a record would be woefully incomplete without it. Thank you very much.
Long, so maybe we'll have time for one question.
And I'm happy to talk to anyone afterward, too, through lunch.
Okay, well, because I have said that they will, I'm sure that any of our presenters will be happy to speak to you after the session, and we'll see you all this afternoon.